Welcome to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. My co-host, Ashley Thornburg, is currently on vacation. In the latter half of today's program, we'll delve into an insightful discussion with Dr. Michael Patrick Cullinane, a professor of history and a distinguished presidential scholar at Dickinson State University. Our conversation will pivot to the much-anticipated presidential campaign featuring a repeat contest between President Biden and former President Trump. But before we venture into political discourse, we'll revisit an engaging conversation with World War II navigator Rolf Slenn. Our dialogue took place at the Fargo Air Museum earlier this year, where Slenn shared captivating memories from his tenure, from embarking on perilous missions to conducting bombing runs in the vicinity of Hiroshima post the atomic bomb detonation. The session was moderated by Max Sabin of the Fargo Air Museum.
Do you recall any difficult missions? And if you are willing, do you recall any one or two of them that really stand out to you?
Yeah, I can remember a number of them. I better start at the beginning. On Christmas Eve Day, 1944, we had the best meal I ever had overseas. We had turkey and mashed potatoes and vegetables and gravy and stuffing. A wonderful meal, Christmas Eve Day, 1944. But a few hours after that, we got a message, you've got to fly on Christmas Day, and your target is a target called Mabalacat. Mabalacat was a very large Japanese airbase on Luzon. Luzon was the most northerly of the big islands in the Philippines. The Japanese were there and controlled all of that area. General MacArthur had landed with his troops in the central area of the Philippines, but the Japanese were still in full control of the northern part of the Philippines. We were awakened about 2 o'clock Christmas Day morning, ate breakfast, rode out to the flight line with our in trucks, got on our airplanes. Our airplanes had been loaded with bombs during Christmas Eve and Christmas Day, filled with gas, bombs and plenty of gas. And we took off on this, what turned out to be a 14-hour flight up against Mabalacat. We were told ahead of time that Mabalacat was surrounded by all kinds of anti-aircraft guns and plenty of Japanese fighter planes. So we knew it was going to be a tough one. We got up there. I think we had just dropped our bombs and were turning away. And suddenly my co-pilot yelled at me and said, "Hey, Slenn, look at this." And I got up and I looked out his window. Here were a bunch of Japanese planes about 2,000 or 3,000 feet above us, and they were dropping phosphorus bombs on top of our formation. And these phosphorus bombs would explode above us, above our formation. And when they exploded, they would send down long streamers of white phosphorus. The idea, I guess, I don't think they were very effective, but the idea was for these streamers to hit our planes and burn holes in those planes. I watched this and I thought, wow, this is just like a Hollywood movie. Japanese planes up here, long explosions of bombs, long streams of phosphorus coming down through our formation. And then the wonderful P-38s, the American fighter plane, they came way down from way above the Japanese planes. They came screaming down towards these Japanese planes. It was just like a Hollywood movie. I was entranced watching the whole thing. It wasn't until I got home from that mission I realized, hey, this is trouble. This looks bad. So we didn't lose a single plane on that mission. Some of the planes, I think we got a few little flak holes in our airplane, but it didn't amount to much. It wasn't until I got home from that mission that I realized, hey, this is dangerous. All that stuff. It wasn't a Hollywood movie at all.
You mentioned during that mission that you encountered Japanese aircraft and flak. Was it pretty common to encounter that while on missions? Do you have any particular stories of any close calls with flak or Zeros or any of those Japanese aircraft of that time?
Yeah, I sure do. This was Christmas Day. We didn't lose a single plane. A few planes got flak holes in them, but nothing very dangerous. But on January 2nd, 1945, we flew another mission up in that very same area against Clark Field. Clark Field had been taken by the Japanese from the Americans early on in the war, and they still occupied Clark Field. We went up there on another long 14-hour flight where you got up at 2 in the morning and didn't get home until 10 at night. We refueled at a base in between, but those were long, long flights. This was another one. What happened was we got up there and we're going to bomb Clark Field, but there was an undercover layer of clouds preventing us from dropping our bombs. We didn't have any radar in those days that amounted to anything. A decision was made by somebody that we'll fly over the target, but we won't drop our bombs. We'll make a huge turn, the entire 24-plane group make a huge turn, and then come back over the target. Hopefully the clouds will be gone by that time and we'll drop our bombs at that time. Well, we did. We dropped our bombs, but shortly after dropping our bombs, first of all, I have to say, I was down in the well of the plane holding the bomb bay doors open because there was some danger that the doors might close accidentally. So I was holding the bomb bay doors open with a lever, and I was looking down out of the bomb bay, and here there was a big explosion, a lot of ack-ack, a lot of flak. The exploding anti-aircraft shells were very close. You could even smell the cordite from the exploding Japanese shells. I drifted into the bomb bay. It is not a nice smell. I almost threw up. But I stayed down there in the bomb bay, and there was a big explosion, and I looked out, and here was the silver wing of a B-24 floating underneath our plane. About the same time, I also saw a huge orange explosion below us. Then, shortly thereafter, a white parachute passed into my view. This white parachute, holding a man, fell into this huge orange explosion and burned up. And I could see the man falling like a rock down to the jungle below. This is very scary, of course. What stuck with me for many years afterwards were the colors. Here was the silver wing. Here was the orange explosion. Here was a white parachute. Here was the green forest down below. And I never could get those colors out of my mind.
You mentioned in the previous that you had been escorted by P-38 Lightnings. Was it pretty common to be escorted into action by P-38s or P-51s or any other type of aircraft?
Mostly P-38s. Now, there were some P-51s, too, later on in 1945. We all thought that P-51 was the most beautiful fighter plane ever invented, and it still is a beautiful plane. Let me tell you about one other mission. It was a mission against a village by the name of Bam Bam, B-A-M-B-A-N, kind of an odd name for a village, but there it was. The reason we were going after that village was because we were told there was a large Japanese military presence there and we were supposed to bomb them. Well, what was so interesting about the mission was that about 2 minutes before I thought we were going to get there, my bombardier said, "Here it is. I think this is it." Well, I was flabbergasted. I was sure there was still at least 2 minutes to go, And here he said he claims he saw the target right below him. And I didn't know what to say. Am I wrong? Is my navigation wrong? Is he looking at the wrong place? I finally stopped talking to him because I didn't know. He could see better than I could. So I just held my breath. I thought, I can't believe it. Well, what he saw was another village, which was very similar to the village we were supposed to bomb. And seconds went by. Nothing happened. Total silence on the intercom. More seconds went by. Nothing happened. Finally, he said, here it is. It turned out to be Bam Ban, and we dropped our bombs there and went home. The scary part of this mission was, what if he had dropped his bombs on the wrong village? He could have killed dozens of Filipinos, and they were, of course, one of our friends during World War II. But he got the right village, but he told me afterwards, I was within a hair's breadth of dropping our bombs on the wrong target. Can you imagine? He might have had to live with that the rest of his life. Might have killed dozens of people.
So in total, how many missions did you fly on?
We flew a total of 40 missions. When we first got over there, we were told we only had to fly about 35, but it was later changed to 40. So we knew at all times that after we had finished 40 missions, we could go home. I want to mention something first to tell you the significance. Early on in the war, it was told to the American people that a Japanese battleship by the name of Karuna had been bombed by an American bomber pilot named Colin Kelly. He was supposed to have flown his B-24 or whatever he was flying right down the smokestacks of this Karuna battleship. This would have been early 1942 or late 1941, shortly after Pearl Harbor. That was totally false. There was no truth whatsoever to this story about bombing the Karuna. I know that to be true because on our 36th mission, we were told to go up to Kure Harbor, K-U-R-E, Kure Harbor, and bomb the Karuna. The Karuna had been active as a Japanese battleship all during the war. It had never been bombed by Colin Kelly. So the Karuna was our target, and it was by far the worst mission we had ever been on, our 36th mission. I want to get back to the Lonesome Lady, because on that mission, our 36th, we flew a different plane. The Lonesome Lady was flown by a Tom Cartwright flying his second mission. He and his crew were a replacement crew. They were shot down on this mission. They were flying right next to us. They were shot down on this mission. People saw parachutes coming out of his plane. His plane lost altitude, finally disappeared in the clouds, and we got home. That was July 28th, 1945. The war in Europe had been over for a couple months, but the war in the Pacific was going full blast in July of 1945. This is a long story, but what happened to the Lonesome Lady? It went down, but what happened to the crew? Did they get out? What happened to them? Did they live? years later, many years later, information trickled back to us about the fate of the Lonesome Lady and the fate of that crew. As it turned out, the pilot and the tail gunner of the Lonesome Lady survived the war. All the rest of that crew were killed when the atomic bomb landed on Hiroshima on August 6th, 1945. Tom Cartwright, who I met many years later, I didn't know him at the time, became a professor down in Texas, I forget the name of the college. He wrote a book about the fate of the Lonesome Lady, and the name of the book that he wrote was A Date with the Lonesome Lady, and so he had survived that mission. He got out of that plane. He was the last one out, and he survived. He was questioned by the Japanese military fairly close to where he got out, where he landed. He just told them everything he knew, which wasn't much. He didn't know anything except where he had flown from. And many of you probably remember that you're only supposed to talk about your name, rank, and serial number. Well, that wasn't applicable at the time. He told them everything he knew. They didn't believe him. So they took him up to Tokyo for more questioning. And he told them everything he knew, where he'd flown from, where they, how they got hit and everything. They didn't believe him then either. They were going to behead him up there in Tokyo. But this was near the end of the war, and I think they were afraid of retribution if they started killing American prisoners. Now, what's also interesting is the story of the tail gunner of Tom Cartwright's plane, the Lonesome Lady. The tail gunner, as soon as that Lonesome Lady was hit, he was out. He got out of that plane real fast. He got out faster than the rest of the crew. He landed quite a distance from where the Lonesome Lady fell and crashed. He landed on top of a, practically on top of a mountain, and he immediately took his parachute off, hid it in the brush someplace, and survived on top of this mountain by doing his best to evade search parties who were looking for him. They knew he had crashed, had landed there, but they couldn't find him. He hid away from them, but he got so hungry, absolutely starved, that he walked down, if you can believe it, he walked down this mountain. He got on a Japanese train and surrendered to a military guy on top of this train. They took him, I think, to Yokohama. So he was nowhere near the Hiroshima, where many of the other crewmen were imprisoned. And all of the crewmen who were imprisoned in Hiroshima all died when the American B-29 and Enola Gay dropped that one bomb on Hiroshima. They all died there along with several hundred thousand Japanese civilians. I met Tom Cartwright years later at one of our reunions. He had acquired somewhere along the line pieces of the Lonesome Lady. How he had gotten these pieces, I don't know. But I've got a piece of the Lonesome Lady right here. It's right in front of us. I think it's a piece from the tail section of the Lonesome Lady. I finally asked him, can I have it? And he said, yeah, okay. So I took it, and there it is, a piece of a lonesome lady right there by those photographs.
Where were you when you heard the news of the atomic bomb drop and the end of the war?
Okay. I've got to try to remember this. The time the lonesome lady was shot down, the mission was July 28, 1945. The atomic bomb was dropped in Hiroshima August 6th, 1945, when the Americans were killed in that explosion. I was on Okinawa, where we were based at that time, flying missions against Japan and a couple against Japanese targets in China, too. When I heard the news of the dropping of this atomic bomb, I just could not believe it. How could one bomb do all that damage? It was unbelievable. We flew missions after that. In fact, we flew one mission the day after the atomic bomb was dropped. And we came within 60 miles of Hiroshima. I looked and looked and looked. I wondered if I could see anything over there. I couldn't see a single thing. So between the time the atomic bomb dropped, August 6th, the next, we flew some more missions. One night, I was sitting on a bench watching an outdoor movie on Okinawa. I don't remember what the movie was, but suddenly I heard some commotion outside the area of the movie. And then people started yelling, "The war is over, the war is over, the war is over." I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe this war that we had been fighting for months was over. A tremendous emotional letdown. I left the movie, I went back to our tent. And then the dumbest thing that the Americans ever did, I think, they started shooting anti-aircraft missiles off in celebration of the end of the war, August 12th. And these missiles, the exploding shrapnel from these anti-aircraft guns that were being shot off to celebrate the end of the war, missiles, particles of these exploding anti-aircraft bombs came down on the Americans located on Okinawa. A just unbelievably stupid thing to do. We didn't get hurt, but it was reported later that almost 20 Americans died from falling anti-aircraft shrapnel that was celebrating the end of the war. So we thought the war was over, August 12th. It was not over. What had happened was the Japanese had offered to surrender on August 12th. As far as we were concerned, the war was not, as far as the American government was concerned, the war was not over. They offered to surrender August 12th, but the offer of surrender was not accepted by us until August 15th. So between August 12th and August 15th, we flew our 40th mission. Can you imagine? We still were fighting that war tooth and nail, even after the Japanese offered to surrender.
We extend our heartfelt gratitude to World War II navigator Rolf Slynn for his service and his willingness to share his history, and to Max Sabin from the Fargo Air Museum. The museum is set to unveil a new exhibit in April, spotlighting the heroic efforts of Eastern North Dakotans and Western Minnesotans who served alongside the heavies in World War II. Stay with us on Main Street for a presidential discussion. That's after this. Welcome back to Main Street. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Today, we're rejoined by Dr. Michael Patrick Cullinane, a distinguished professor of history and a renowned presidential scholar from Dickinson State University. Dr. Cullinane returns to Main Street to offer his expert insights into the eagerly awaited and anticipated presidential campaign featuring former President Donald Trump and the incumbent President Joe Biden. He'll have thoughtful analysis on what promises to be a historic election season. And Dr. Michael Patrick Cullinane is now my guest. He's a celebrated historian of American politics and an award-winning author. He's a professor of U.S. history at Dickinson State University. Dr. Cullinane, welcome back to Main Street.
Great to be back, Craig. Thanks for having me.
Lots to chat about today. I think I led off one of our discussions with, and then there were five, and I was talking only then about Republican candidates left standing for president. And now I'm going to say, and now there were two, and this is for the general election that many are touting as the earliest general election beginning in history. I want to take us to a week ago, Dr. Cullinane, when North Dakota held their caucuses. And let's begin there. Of course, North Dakota chose former President Donald Trump as its Republican nominee for president, but very few people participated. And I wondered, what is the difference really between caucuses and primaries? And what's a better way to have more participation? And is it something that should be concerning to voters?
It is something that I think should be concerning. I'm not sure everyone knows what a caucus is because not everyone takes part in a caucus. And that's even if your state has a caucus for the primaries. So the main difference between caucuses and primaries is that primaries are much like regular general election voting. You go into a booth, you cast your ballot, it's private, and then you walk away and you're done. A caucus is an in-person, usually a public gathering of sorts, usually in a designated polling center, but that the polling centers are not quite the same as the primary polling centers. They usually require some sort of registration, which means that you need to disclose your name and identity and sometimes even pay a fee to join the caucus. So you can imagine these are all things that would turn voters off from attending a caucus. You need, it's no longer in secret. There may be a cost or a registration involved. You're sharing your opinion about the election and who you want to vote for in public with other people. So that can be a real big turnoff for some people.
All right. So here we are with two candidates. Last Wednesday, after Super Tuesday, Nikki Haley withdrew. What do you take away from her not endorsing former President Trump, but saying something similar to she hopes he does well?
That's a real change in tone from her camp, because, of course, before she went into the debates, all of those candidates had to declare that they would support the eventual nominee. And now she's saying that because Donald Trump is sort of reneging on some of his promises, that she's going to renege on hers, which I don't think is a good look in general. But ultimately, she's out now. I mean, you know, her campaign has been suspended. I think really her departure is kind of like most elections. I mean, if you look back to the early 2000s or even 2012, really by about this time, Super Tuesday, that is, most candidates had been weeded out. And in the case of 2012, for example, Mitt Romney won all but one state. And that was the same case on Super Tuesday. Nikki Haley won Vermont, and that was it. So she's out now. And this kind of feels a little bit more like a general election now without any sort of distractions from either in-party contenders.
On we went to the State of the Union address. And of course, many framed it as President Biden's launch of his reelection campaign. What role traditionally, Dr. Cullinane, has the State of the Union speech played in presidential campaigns?
It's a mixed bag, obviously, because the State of the Union is announced every year by the president. Some years are not election years. This year being an election year, it naturally has more impact on the campaign. And that's really what Biden was setting out. He had, I would say, four major categories of campaign issues that he talked about. Immigration naturally was number one, where he talked about how the Republican Party, you know, shot down a bipartisan effort for immigration reform. Abortion was probably the loudest and most fiery talk that he gave. He basically put abortion on par with the civil rights movement and stated the Democrats' case for a return to Roe versus Wade. The economy was there big time, and then foreign policy with Gaza and Ukraine. So these issues that are going to dominate the campaign were a huge feature, if the only feature, really, of the State of the Union.
Historically, have others used the State of the Union addressed as a launch to their campaign to the extent that President Biden did?
I think in some cases they have, certainly in recent memory. But if we go way, way back, the State of the Union message was a message. It wasn't something that was done by the presidents publicly. So the first president to make a public address to Congress on the State of the Union was Woodrow Wilson back in 1913 or 14. So historically, the message has been really nonpartisan, nonpolitical. It's just been a sort of telling of the state of the nation. Nowadays, it's in election years, it's very much political. I mean, we see this too in every year in the last, say, 35, 40 years, where half of the chamber will get up to support the president, and that's the president's party, and the other chamber will stay seated. Or in some cases, like at the State of the Union a couple nights ago, someone screamed out, liar, which has become more and more popular for Congress people to actually try and interrupt the president. That's a new change.
Here we are coming to the time in November when we're going to have to vote. And many were saying over the weekend, they're going to vote against a candidate, someone they oppose, rather than voting for someone they really support. Do you expect this dynamic to play out in the upcoming election, Biden versus Trump?
Well, this is a rematch of 2020. And I think in some cases, 2020 was an election that Biden won because Trump lost. And what I mean by that is that people voted against Trump in 2020 more than voting for Biden. So if we take that as the case in 2020, then I don't see why 2024 would be any different. I mean, if you look at the approval ratings of presidents in the 21st century, they've been relatively low, even when you have George W. Bush in 2024 running for re-election, there was people that were vehemently opposed. The nation's politics has become so divisive, really, in the late 20th and early 20th centuries now, that people with a low approval rating can still win a huge proportion of the vote. So take Donald Trump in 2020. His approval rating was 34%. Now, he still won 47% of the electorate. So that's what I mean about saying there's people that are sort of holding their nose and voting for a candidate despite the fact that they don't like them.
Most people believe this election will be close. Is that a view that you share?
I do think it's going to be close. I can't see how it won't be. If we're looking at swing states in particular, I think it's going to be very close. I mean, if I was going to say who has the upper hand, I'm going to be a contrarian here and say that actually, I think Joe Biden has a slightly better hand than Donald Trump does. Although all the news will say that Donald Trump is winning in swing states. If we take 2020 as the baseline, right, for where we need to be in 2024, or what it's going to look like in 2024, Georgia, Arizona, and Nevada, three swing states, Biden can lose all three of those and still win the election. Trump needs those three states plus another one to win. So he's really got to peel off a lot of voters in several swing states, I think. It really is maybe six, seven states that I think will decide this election, and I think might decide the next seven elections or eight elections from now. And that's Georgia, which recently swung blue, Arizona, which recently swung blue, Nevada, Pennsylvania. I think Michigan is solid blue now. I think Wisconsin looks solid blue now. So, you know, Florida and Ohio, they've always been kind of bellwether states as well. But no, I mean, you shouldn't be surprised, I guess, that Wyoming is solid red or North Dakota is solid red. I can't imagine that changing for a long time to come.
All right, let's talk about each candidate's path to victory. In your estimation, what is former President Donald Trump's path to victory?
Well, Donald Trump needs to pull off what he pulled off in 2016, which was a rare upset in American political history. He needs to win what was called the Blue Wall, which listeners will remember are states like Pennsylvania, Michigan, Ohio, better known as the Rust Belt, I guess, Wisconsin. Now, those states since 2016 have definitely moved to the left. Michigan is a really good example. Michigan and the abortion issue in Michigan in particular has moved far, far to the left from where it was in 2016. And what's worse for Republicans in that state is the state's Republican committee and party is really a basket case. They can't get their act together. They've elected a number of leaders who are struggling to raise funds. And so I think Michigan is nearly a write-off at this stage for the Republicans. The thing that Trump needs to focus on is Georgia, turning it back into red, Arizona, and I think Kerry Lake is working fastidiously to turn that state Republican, and Nevada, which for I can't remember how many elections now, has gone with the Democrats. So he needs to win those three plus another one. I think Pennsylvania is a big ask, but maybe he can peel off a state like Wisconsin.
All right. What's Joe Biden's path to reelection?
Well, Joe Biden, I think, needs to go to Arizona and Georgia every day of the next 365 days or so. You know, those two states are critically important. And I think, you know, with Georgia, he's proven that the field campaigning, you know, the likes of Stacey Abrams and the two senators there, Warnock and at the young chap's name from Georgia. But, you know, their field campaign is really strong. If they can keep that up, they have a real chance of holding Georgia. But like I said, without Georgia, Arizona and Nevada, Biden can still win just based on the numbers. He gets to 273, even losing those three states. So although I know the polls say that Biden is behind in these places, I think he's still in a better position overall.
We're enjoying our conversation with Dr. Michael Patrick Cullinane. He's a professor at Dickinson State University. Dr. Cullinane, who will be former President Trump's vice presidential pick? And what role do you think that VP will play in this election?
Oh, well, this is a tough question. I mean, I don't know. Did everyone see Mike Pence becoming the VP candidate in 2016? And I think 2024 is going to be a really interesting one. Carrie Lake has been talked about. I think that's a smart move because she's from Arizona. Of course, she's running for Senate, though, so that might not be likely. There's also talk of Vivek Ramaswamy maybe being the candidate, and many others have been speculated as well. I don't think we'll know who it's going to be until the last minute, really. And there'll be strategic decisions about what state that person is from and where they can garner votes. And really, that's what it's going to boil down to in many regards. Can the vice presidential candidate add to the ticket? If that person can't, then they won't be there.
Can you draw any parallels between the upcoming Biden-Trump campaign from any past presidential campaigns in American history?
In terms of reruns, yeah. I mean, if we go back to the 1880s, Grover Cleveland and Benjamin Harrison, they reran their campaign in 1892, and it was a victory for Cleveland that time. So Cleveland is actually the only president who has had non-consecutive terms, which is effectively what Donald Trump is looking to do. And the 1892 election was pretty interesting because voters were very familiar with Cleveland and with Harrison. What's also interesting with history is that we have hindsight. Voters, after they elected Cleveland in 1892, were really despondent because Cleveland tanked the economy almost immediately. There was a massive depression in the United States in 1893, and they turned on Cleveland basically permanently after that. So be careful what you wish for, I guess, is what history teaches us.
As of today, do you expect to see presidential debates?
That's a great question. I just don't know. And I think this is something that is going to be one of the most interesting things is, have we already seen the last presidential debate? I think Biden is reluctant to do this because, well, I mean, I think Trump has been hammering Biden on his age. And just the other day, he was talking about Biden's list for speech impediments or stutters. And I think that's been hurting Biden in the polls. And whether he wants to confront that on a national debating stage, I think is probably unlikely. The problem is, too, is that as much as Donald Trump says that he wants to debate Biden, and that might make him look like he is a willing participant, we know that he stonewalled Republican candidates throughout the primary contest because it suited him too. So he doesn't really have much of a sort of moral high ground to stand there. He didn't debate his own Republican contenders. So what does Biden have to lose by saying, I don't want to debate Trump?
How about vice presidential debates? And has it ever been the case where we've only had VP debates instead of presidential debates?
I don't know. That's a great question about whether there's ever been vice presidential debates and not presidential ones. I mean, going back to the 1960s when presidential debates really took off and were televised, I can't remember a time when that's happened. But it may be the case later, earlier in history, that there has been vice presidential debates without presidential debates. I don't think the vice presidential debates are hugely consequential. If we're seeing Kamala Harris, if she's the candidate, which I suspect she will be for the Biden campaign, who knows who she's going to take on in the vice presidential Republican candidate. But either way, I don't think they've ever been really consequential. I mean, the most lasting memory I have of vice presidential debates is when Lloyd Bentsen said to Dan Quayle, I knew Kennedy and you're no Kennedy. And that was kind of it. It was a good one-liner, but it didn't sway any voter. And of course, Bush and Quayle won that election anyway.
Who's the head in the money game? And what about super PACs influencing this election?
Well, this is really interesting. So this could go a number of ways as well. So right now, Joe Biden is ahead in the money game. And let me break down the numbers for you a little bit. He's got $56 million on hand. Donald Trump's campaign has $30 million on hand. So that's a sizable, almost double amount of cash that's on hand at this stage. The other thing that looks bad for the Trump campaign is that Biden raised more money and has so far spent less money than Donald Trump. So in just about every metric, Joe Biden is ahead in the money game. And for anyone who thinks that that doesn't matter, that's sort of naive. The money game is important, whether you're raising it from small individual donations or massive corporations. It does matter. And here's where it gets even more confusing. Will the indictments and any fines that come from any convictions that Donald Trump has accrued, which so far are pretty substantial, I mean, if you look, $360 million at least, where does that money come from? Does it come from the Trump Corporation, or can the campaign pay for some of that? But of course, if that's coming out of campaign coffers, that's less money for advertising, less money for field campaigns. It's not looking good in terms of money for the Trump campaign.
Based on past campaigns and what you expect in the future, and also the current use of technologies, what strategies, Mike, do you think that we will see in this upcoming campaign from both either Biden or Trump?
Well, that's a great question about media, because I think for every year, the media changes a little bit, but not, I don't think it's as incremental this year as it was, say, in 2016, when Donald Trump and Twitter were kind of a fresh new way of greeting and meeting the electorate. Nowadays, it seems like it's more of the same, more social media, and it's going to be more important. We saw Joe Biden recently on Super Bowl Sunday do a TikTok. That's the first time that he was using TikTok as a campaign vehicle. Trump is, of course, still got Truth Media, but I don't think many people look at that except for journalists who wind up reporting on things that Trump said. Social media is still going to be important. We're still going to see a lot of use of YouTube, of Instagram, even Facebook, you know, which is nominally on the way out for most people, is still going to be important. But let's not forget that the radio and television still play a huge role, especially for voters that are over, say, 55. Those voters also come out in droves. They probably come out more reliably than 18 to 35 year olds, which is that key demographic for social media. So I think it's going to be the same approach. I don't see any new media on the horizon. But these social medias are, you know, if you have a novel way of using them and you can figure out how to, you know, reach your group, then, you know, that's a powerful tool.
Do you anticipate this campaign will be any more or less negative than past presidential campaigns? And is there any other campaign historically that you can say relative to how this will be negative or this will be positive, that's what you're going to see here?
Well, I think the good thing is only 4 years ago, we saw the same candidates. So we have a pretty good idea of how it's going to look and how it's going to shake out. The thing about this campaign as well is we're not really learning a whole lot more from these candidates. We already know who Donald Trump is. We already know who Joe Biden is. They're both presidents. I suppose that's a rarity that, you know, we have two presidents running an election. That doesn't often happen. But I don't think we're going to see that much new here in terms of negativity. I think you can expect Joe Biden's age and possibly Trump's age as well to be a major target, which is kind of a little bit strange given the fact that 4 years ago, he was only 4 years younger.
Right.
But there's something here, I think, about age and the personal pot shots already taking place. I mean, both of them have made personal pot shots. So I think the negativity is there.
In addition to age, is immigration going to be the stalwart issue that we're going to hear about over and over in this campaign?
I mean, I think if you're a Republican, immigration is going to be the number one concern. The message that the Trump campaign is going to hammer on and on and on about is migration south of the U.S. border. However, if you're a Democrat, I don't think immigration is going to be the biggest issue. I think abortion is going to be the biggest issue. And interestingly, this is where we have the fracturing of our political society. You know, it's not the same issue for the same people. I mean, the economy might be the only thing that Democrats and Republicans both see as a common issue, but immigration doesn't bother Democrats anywhere near as much as it bothers Republicans. And abortion, obviously, is a win. You know, the end of Roe versus Wade is a major win for most Republicans. And for the Democrats, they seek to overturn that recent ruling. So I think it depends on what side you're on. I suppose the other thing is foreign policy might feature more in this election than it has in previous elections. Because we have two major wars going on, one in the Middle East and one in Ukraine, and between Ukraine and Russia, this is unusual. And the United States plays an oversized role in both of those conflicts. So, you know, we've seen this play out in Congress, in the halls of Congress in recent weeks and months. Whether the United States continues to fund these two wars is going to play into the eventual November election.
Dr. Michael Patrick Cullinan is a celebrated historian of American politics and an award-winning author. He's a professor of U.S. history and the Robin Melanie Walton Chair of Theodore Roosevelt Studies at Dickinson State University. We turn to him for all things about presidents. Dr. Cullinan, thanks for joining us on Main Street.
Thanks for having me.
Dakota Datebook follows. Stay with us.
Want to improve your relationships with colleagues and clients? Consider the benefits of unique perspectives and ideas. Entrepreneur Chloe Valderi developed Theory of Enchantment, a diversity, equity, and inclusion program that utilizes pop culture. Through film, music, and literature, you can learn how to embrace and create a more open-minded workplace. You can join Chloe Valderi and Humanities North Dakota on April 18th in Fargo for an unconventional approach to DEI. More information online at humanitiesnd.org.
North Dakota Native American Essential Understanding Number 2 is about learning and storytelling. It states, "Traditional teaching and the passing on of knowledge and wisdom was done through storytelling, song, ceremony, and daily way of life, often incorporating specific gender and age-specific responsibilities. These continue to be some of the best modes for learning for both Native and non-Native learners." In this episode of Dakota Datebook, we'll listen to Eileen Little Ghost, Lakota Elder, as she talks about the medicine wheel.
Because we use the west, this blue, where the thunder beings come because it's blue. Blue water, and then the north is the buffalo, because the buffalo can face the storm and survive. It's the winter time, and that's where Santa Claus comes from too. The red and the yellow is sunrise east when the baby's born. Grandma, the teepee's always faces east. Grandma would take the baby. As soon as the baby's born, either boy or girl, she comes out of the teepee. She says, "Recognize this little baby boy. He comes into the world to join us. Someday he'll be a president." And then the South makes me cry, because when South is white, because that's where all our, when we pass on, we go to that Milky Way. We go into the Milky Way. Those are the colors we live by. And of course, Tokashila and Mother Earth. We shouldn't forget Mother Earth. Yeah, she's green. The green flag is for a green Mother Earth.
I'm Sharla Stever. If you'd like to learn more about the North Dakota Native American Essential Understandings and to listen to more Indigenous elder interviews, visit www.teachingsofourelders.org. Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota. Funding for this series is from Humanities ND and the North Dakota Department of Public Instruction.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
And that's a wrap for today's Main Street. Remember, you can hear this and all past episodes of Main Street at our website at prairiepublic.org or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. Tomorrow on the show, we'll hear from winners of North Dakota's Poetry Out Loud contest with our former director of radio, Bill Thomas. And we'll also preview the Fargo-Moorhead Orchestra's Masterworks 4, The Four Seasons of Vietnam and Tchaikovsky. We hope to see you again tomorrow on Main Street.